Hello and welcome back to Linquiry, the show that asks and attempts to answer questions related to the language and communication sciences. Every episode, we'll be looking at a central question or linquiry submitted by a listener of ours of the show, and we will have an amazing guest expert help us unpack the question and talk about all of the wonderful things that is the human superpower of language. My name is Aiden. I'm co-host. I am an undergraduate student in the speech language hearing sciences.
And I'm Emily, a graduate student also in speech language and hearing sciences.
Awesome. So without further ado, let us get into our listener submitted linquiry of the day.
Hi, I'm Vin and I'm from Connecticut. I went to school with someone who stuttered and always wondered about the condition and its causes. What exactly is stuttering? How does it affect those who have it? And what support options are available for those who stutter?
So, Emily, we have quite a popular question within the field. At least that's what my impression is. I don't know if you agree.
Yes, absolutely. I think that stuttering is definitely a, I don't know if I can think of a better phrase other than a hot topic currently. Because it's kind of the treatment and the view that we have of stuttering has kind of changed over time, I think. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the thing that comes to mind with this is just sort of the overall cultural views of stuttering.
Yes,
and people absolutely. With stuttering has evolved greatly and still is changing.
Yes.
Let's start to unpack our linquiry here. Who do we have on today to help us do that?
So we have a very special guest today, my friend and fellow graduate student in the speech, language, and hearing sciences, and a person who stutters, Matt Phillips.
Awesome. Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for... thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're so excited to talk to you, Matt. I think you are, I've told you this probably a billion times at this point, but such a great resource and such a cool perspective, not only being a person who stutters, but also being a future speech and language pathologist.
Yeah. Thank you.
So let's just kick it off and maybe just talk about kind of set the scene of what is stuttering. I know that's a kind of a broad question, but Matt, to you, how would you describe stuttering?
So stuttering, if we think of it in the traditional sense, especially coming from the field of speech language pathology, is a communication disorder, a communication difference that is characterized by a disruption in the forward moving fluency of speech production. It can look like a lot of different things. A lot of what is traditionally thought of to be stuttering include things such as repetitions, prolongations, and blocks. So that is kind of a quick snapshot of how it's thought of broadly in the field, but there's been a lot of discussion, especially recently, about if the disfluencies that constitute stuttering should be the main focus in speech therapy, as stuttering can come with a lot of social, psychological, and quality of life consequences outside of just the physical speech disfluencies.
Yeah, I feel like it captures a lot of the complexities that we're going to sort of discuss. I like that, Matt. I really like that you brought up the psychosocial factors. I feel like that's something that's lost on a lot of people, especially outside of the field. I'm going to use that to kind of transition to, I guess, a question that I have is, you know, when were you first diagnosed as a person who stutters? Did it happen earlier on in your life, or was it something that happened later on? And can you just kind of talk to us about that experience and its impact on your early years?
Yeah. So I was Yeah, so I began to stuttering. I began to stutter in childhood. I believe that my mom and dad say I began at about 2.5. Most people who stutter begin between about 2 to 4, 2 to 6. Mm-hmm. So I was right in that age window. And so I saw a lot of SLPs in the public schools and things like that. So I would say that in early childhood, stuttering didn't necessarily have a huge impact on my life, and that didn't really come until I was like in like my adolescent stage of life. I always knew that I talked a little bit differently than most people, and that sometimes I might get stuck on sounds, I might repeat things, but it didn't have a huge life impact as a young child.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting. And do you have other peers that you know who stutter, who have had different experiences? And if so, what do you think may have been the cause of those different experiences? Or were you pretty much a lone wolf growing up?
Yeah, so I didn't know a lot of other people who stutter until I was about 15, 16, especially those at my own age. But with the people who stutter that I do know, I know there has kind of been a wide range of experiences in that some didn't have a whole lot of life impact as a child, but for some people that's when the whole life impact piece really began.
So. But I think that's super interesting that you were diagnosed so young, because that is on like the very early end of the window that typically people would start to stutter.
Yeah, so I began receiving speech therapy that I can recall when I was in elementary school. And I would be pulled out of class. I would go down to speech. But at the time, I feel like there wasn't a whole lot of focus put on actually talking about what stuttering was. So at the time, I obviously knew that I talked differently. And I knew I would go to speech and that we would focus on different ways of talking, like slowing down and pausing and all of these things, to try and increase how fluent I was. But there wasn't a whole lot of talking about what stuttering itself was. And I feel like that was something that would have been helpful at the time. Because while I might talk about it while my mom or my dad might talk about it at home, it wasn't talked about by the SLP that I was seeing at the time. So I didn't really know like if I wanted to talk about it with a teacher or with people in class. Like I didn't really know how to go about that, especially as a child.
That's super interesting. So would you consider your experiences mostly positive? Do you think that was something? I know now it's a weird coincidence, I guess. Let's backtrack a little bit. What made you want to go into speech?
So I guess I'll probably touch on both of those questions now. I wanted to go into speech language pathology because I had some good speech therapy, but I also had some not so helpful speech therapy. And while I was in high school, I began going to the National Stuttering Association annual conference, and I had met a few other people who stutter, who had either gone on to become SLPs or who had been in school to become SLPs. And I was like, oh, I didn't really ever like think of that as an option. But all of the SLPs I talked to said they found it enjoyable. And they found that as somebody who stutters, they felt like they could connect to the clients they helped at a different level. And while I was in high school, I actually saw an SLP who stuttered himself. So that was something that was helpful as well.
Wow, that's awesome. I didn't know that you had an SLP who also stuttered. That's such a unique experience. And I'm sure it's you're lucky to have had that experience, because I'm sure the number of SLPs who stutter is few and far between.
Yeah.
Just statistically, but I'm glad that you have some positive experiences, or maybe that's, you know, a driving force towards why you wanted to be a speech pathologist, to create more positive experiences for those others who stutter. So you kind of touched on a little bit about the National Stuttering Association. I would love for you to tell us more about, you know, how you became involved and what you've done with the National Stuttering Association.
Yeah, so I began going to the NSA annual conferences in the summer of 2015. I began going because my mom found out about them and wanted me to go. I didn't want to go at the time, but I went because she wanted me to, so that's what happened. But it was definitely a life-changing experience going to the NSA conferences, because it's typically attended between between 600 to 900, 1,000 people. And most of them are all people who stutter, are people who know somebody who stutters. So it's a very unique place in that most people in the hotel that the convention is at all happen to stutter. So it's kind of a funny experience, especially if there's people in the hotel who don't stutter or who don't know there's a convention happening, because they notice all these people talking differently, but there's like so many of them.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's always kind of funny. I've been going to the NSA since 2015. I've been to 9 of the annual conferences. And as I said, it was just a life-changing thing to go to, especially meeting so many people my own age. At the time, I was 15. So being able to meet other teens who stutter, people in college, it was just very eye-opening seeing all of these other people who understand what it's like to stutter, and also to see adults who have gone on to have like successful lives, both personally and professionally, especially like people who have jobs that have to do a lot of talking in. So seeing like attorneys, teachers, physicians, like, so seeing these people who have jobs that they have to like talk all day, that was a pretty eye-opening thing.
It's just so cool to hear about like the community that you're able to find. And again, this kind of goes back, like you were saying, to this, like all those psychosocial factors that you don't think about with stuttering. It's not just the physical condition, it's very much a psychological one. And so I think it's really cool to listen to your experiences about finding community. And I'm sure we're going to touch upon that very shortly. But I have a question. Like you've mentioned, and I think it's something I want to focus on. You've mentioned a couple times this word of difference, right? Of talking differently, of communicating differently. Can you expand a little bit more on why it's so important that we use that kind of vocabulary when we talk about stuttering or fluency disorders, or really just any in the context of speech language pathology in the field that we're all studying? What can you kind of just comment on what and that important distinction between like difference versus disorder and your experiences coming across those two terms, either as a clinician or being someone who receives therapy services. Sorry if that was all over the place.
No. Yeah. And I think that's a good question. And it's also something that even within the stuttering community is a kind of a hot button issue as to, is stuttering a disability? Is it a disorder? Is it a difference? So it's definitely a good question. So I guess to begin, stuttering is often called a type of fluency disorder. So that's kind of like how it begins. And it does kind of make sense in that most people can speak most people do not stutter. Most people speak fluently. But then if you begin to kind of like challenge that a little bit more in depth, most people, even if they don't stutter, don't speak fluently all the time. Mm-hmm. So obviously most people say like at some point. Most people mm-hmm. might say something wrong, have to go back and fix it. So it's like most people don't have this total fluency.
Mm-hmm.
So then it kind of becomes like, what is the line between typical fluency, between typical like disfluency that we all have and stuttering?
Yeah, so, good point.
Right. So stuttering is thought. So we know that there are some neurological differences between people who do and do not stutter. And we also know that the type of disfluencies we see in people who stutter look different than those who don't. So in people who stutter, you might see repetitions, prolongations, and blocks. And in people who don't, you'll also see repetitions. Except you'll see maybe less prolongations, and you'll especially see a less amount of blocking. So the type of disfluencies look a lot different between stuttering and how people who don't stutter can be disfluent.
For the listeners, like I feel like, and this is something that I had in my head before I got into the field, it's like disfluency is an umbrella term in itself.
Yes.
There's so many, like you were saying, there's so many different patterns of disfluency, and those patterns kind of tell us a different narrative. And I imagine too, it also depends on the individual as well.
Yeah. So that's exactly it. And then that's when it kind of gets into, is it a difference? Is it a disorder? And sort of like what makes something a difference or a disorder? Because the fact that we all speak with some degree of disfluency, people who stutter just happen to have a greater amount and different types of disfluency. So that's kind of at least how I think about it, because it's just how people who stutter talk. It doesn't necessarily have to be a good thing. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. So I think if we have a speech disorder, I think that kind of has a negative connotation with it, opposed to how fluent or how disfluent somebody is. I don't think should have that kind of judgment attached to it.
Yeah, no, I that's really interesting that you bring that up, because you know, as we're just talking too, you know, like what is, it's such a subjective thing anyway, like who decides if something's fluent versus not fluent, you know, mm-hmm. like at the end of the day, as long as like we're all using language to communicate, if the message is received, then what does the fluency really matter, I guess? Is that, you know what I mean? Like,
exactly. And yeah. I have two kind of follow-up points. Is that if we think of the goal of speaking is to typically communicate with people, people who stutter can also be effective communicators in the same way that people who don't stutter can be ineffective. I'm sure we've all had a teacher, a professor who's not very good at explaining things, who's not very good at engaging students, and isn't very good at conveying the message they want. So I think it's important to kind of move away from the idea that fluency is what makes somebody effective at communicating. So that was point one. And the second point is that we've been talking a lot about fluency, because that's what most people think of when they think of stuttering. But I think it's also important to focus on the on the social, emotional, and the cognitive side of things, because it's totally possible, and it happens, that the amount of disfluencies that somebody has and like the impact that has on somebody are not totally so the amount of stuttering that somebody does and the impact that has on someone's life is not related, and we know that from both listening to what people who stutter say, as well as some of the research in the field that supports that. Because we, within people who stutter, there's a subset of them who are often called covert people who stutter, and they are people who stutter who are basically so skilled at avoiding and concealing the fact that they stutter that to the average listener, people wouldn't be able to tell that they stutter. Except those people can often feel a big life impact because they're spending so much time thinking about how they can conceal the fact they stutter. They might feel intense shame if they can't hide the fact they stutter. They might feel anxiety about other people finding out that they stutter and how that might change what they think of them. So I think it's especially important to focus on the quality of life and life impact when we think about what makes something, how we think about something. So someone can have a high frequency of stuttering, but they might have very low life impact. Just because somebody is disfluent, because they stutter to a greater extent than most people, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank you for like laying out all of those different sort of like dimensions to this whole situation, because there's just so much there and it's so nuanced. If you don't mind, what are some of the biggest sort of psychosocial factors that we've kind of touched upon, but what are some of the biggest ones that you've come across personally or that you think in general are the most sort of the biggest challenges or the most salient for individuals who stutter?
So I think some of the big things that can have a big impact on quality of life, it's kind of like what I mentioned, the extent that people go to conceal the fact that they stutter. And in fact, there was a study that was published by she's now a professor at Western Michigan, her name is Dr. Hope Gerlach Hauck, and she did a study, and she was trying to predict psychological distress in people who stutter. And I don't remember off the top of my head how she did that, but I believe it was a composite measure of symptoms of anxiety and of depression. And what she found was that when predicting decreased, when she was predicting increased psychological distress, I believe what she found was that one of, if not the biggest predictors, was the extent people went to hide the fact that they stutter above and beyond the amount the individual stutter. So I think that's a big one, the amount that people try to conceal.
Yeah, that's huge.
The fact they stutter. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that is, yeah, I think that's very telling. And honestly, it seems like it should be a natural jumping off point for how we talk about stuttering and how we handle clinical management and diagnosis, like, in general.
I think that's a huge, like Aiden kind of just said, a huge jumping off point, especially because I think that's kind of the point that has changed how we think about speech therapy when it comes to stuttering. Mm-hmm. Like Matt said, it's not necessarily trying to make the person more fluent. It's all of the psychosocial aspects that come along with stuttering. And as Matt just touched on, like concealing, or, you know, that basically exactly what Matt said with, you know, quality of life and the amount a person stutters aren't necessarily correlating. It's more so a lot of other aspects that lead into that, which is now hopefully what we're going to be focusing on in speech therapy. On that note, in your opinion, both as a SLP grad student and a person who stutters, what do you think is best practice for speech therapy, specifically for stuttering?
So in my opinion, and what a lot of the research supports, which is also how I support this opinion, is that I think that speech therapy for stuttering needs to move away from the traditional goals focused on fluency and increasing fluency, and switch to how we can help people feel comfortable and confident as communicators, whether or not they stutter. And I think that's a change that definitely needs to continue happening, because as I'm sure most SLPs will attest to, in graduate school, when you are taught about stuttering, or if you have a stuttering client, most of the two big treatment approaches that are usually taught include fluency shaping and stuttering modification. And fluency shaping is the traditional approach of trying to stutter as little as possible and to speak as fluently as possible. And I think that still comes up a lot. So we'll have techniques such as having the client slow down when they talk, having them pause when they talk.
Yeah, classics.
Having them string things together on the same breath when they talk. And that also, in the way that I was just talking, it can also lead to a way of speaking that also might be fluent, but doesn't sound typical, because the type of fluency people who stutter have is spontaneous. It happens without thinking, opposed to with fluency shaping, you can already tell as I'm doing it, it sounds much different than most spontaneous fluent speech does. So mm-hmm. I think that's also something to keep in mind, is that something like fluency shaping is really just changing one way of speaking, stuttering, that may not be how most people talk. And it's trying to get people to speak fluently, except the fluent speech that comes out of it doesn't sound like what spontaneous fluency is. As well as the fact, it's important to note, a lot of clients who stutter can do fluency shaping very well in a clinical setting, but it's incredibly difficult to take it out of the clinic and to do it every day, every time you speak, and it becomes less and less effective over time. And there's no evidence that I've been able to find that these fluency shaping techniques lead to the same spontaneous fluency that people who don't stutter have.
Wow. I never knew any of that about fluency shaping. I mean, you guys are the grad students, so it makes sense that I may not have come across it, but that's something that I don't think I would have ever considered. I mean, you brought up a good point, Matt. It's like, when it comes to fluency, it's like, okay, sure, we can focus on getting, you know, the right sounds coming out and everything sounding nice and like orderly, but then you risk this sort of naturalistic way of communicating. I imagine there's a, you know, prosody is going to be impacted if you're so focused on trying to get those individual like articulations. Then how does that affect your tone and the rhythm that you're using and your intonation? I mean, all those things, I feel like there's a risk of maybe a negative impact to those other factors, those mm-hmm. super mental, if you will, factors of speech and communication, all just because you're trying to get these specific phonemes or speech sounds to be just quite right. I mean, to me, it just seems kind of like silly and not really the best use of time.
Yeah. And I mean, especially since it doesn't generalize well.
Yeah, exactly.
I totally agree. And Matt, I think, like you said, being a grad student, we definitely are still taught a lot of these fluency shaping techniques because that is the only quote unquote treatments that I guess have been around for a long time, not necessarily meaning that they're actually helpful, like you said, in carryover, and it's kind of like replacing one quote unquote unnatural form of speech for another unnatural form of speech. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you know, stuttering is natural to you because that's your manner of speaking, and other yeah. people speak that way as well. So I think that's a really great point, and that's a really good way to think about it, and kind of focusing on the social aspects more so, and making the person who stutters comfortable in their own skin is the most important, kind of how you touched on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a great point. So I think kind of tying it all together, you being a grad student, what are some of like your aspirations as a future speech pathologist? It's kind of, you know, what we already talked about too, but overall, you know, what are your goals once you become an SLP?
Yeah. So I think I definitely want to continue focusing on stuttering and things like that. And providing high quality speech therapy to other people who stutter. Because aside from fluency shaping and stuttering modification, there are a lot of other good approaches that can be used that focus a lot more on acceptance and effective and spontaneous communication, reducing avoidance behaviors in terms of whether or not you choose to speak in a situation, as well as reducing some of the secondary behaviors of stuttering as well. So an example of a type of treatment approach is avoidance reduction therapy, which is a which is an approach to stuttering therapy developed by Joseph Sheehan, who is a psychologist at UCLA and has been continued by Vivian Siskin, who is a clinical professor emerita at the University of Maryland. And so with an approach like that, which is what I want to focus more on as a clinician, is it focuses not on fluency, but it focuses on communication as a whole. So maybe it focuses on reducing the amount of times a client says like as a way to avoid stuttering. Maybe it focuses on challenging them to speak in different situations that they might not in the past. So say we have a student who won't speak at all in class and who won't give a presentation in class, who feels very uncomfortable doing those things, maybe we can focus on whether or not they continue to stutter. We can focus on, okay, maybe we have them feel comfortable participating in class. And that can be done through sort of like cutting down on the struggle they feel while talking and not necessarily how much they stutter. So that's definitely the approach that I want to continue doing as an SLP when I'm treating clients who stutter. And that's also not a lot of like speech therapy research has been conducted about stuttering. So I'm interested in that as well. Potentially going on to do a PhD at some point, focusing on some of the clinical aspects of stuttering.
Quite the plan, Matt. And I have no doubt that you're going to do it all, because you've already made quite the impact just at UConn and sort of in the community that you're working. So that sounds, I can't wait to see like what you do with that. That's so cool. I meant to ask this earlier, but when we were talking about just like effective versus, you know, maybe not so effective stuttering treatments and from mm-hmm. things that you've experienced and the things that you'll be implementing as a clinician now and later on, but what, you know, I've heard talk, let's say, about a particular, usually I think it's a graduate assignment that's given to the grad students, but it's very controversial. I don't know if you guys have come across this at UConn or in your classes, but there's a stuttering assignment that apparently is like a traditional assignment given to grad students where you're supposed to go out into the world, go and order a coffee or go to a doctor's appointment or go somewhere in public and pretend to have a stutter. And the assignment is to, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, pseudo stuttering.
Yes, pseudo stuttering. This is, from what I could see, this thing has people split down the middle so much. Some people think it's the most ridiculous, terrible, ableist assignment, and other people think it's very useful. Matt, as someone who actually, what do you think of this assignment?
Yeah, so I definitely have seen how it's kind of a hot button assignment. And I don't have any issue with it as somebody who stutters. And a lot of the people who stutter that I've talked to about it also don't have any issue with it. And okay. I'll kind of explain why at least I don't have an issue with it. So, okay. So I think a lot of the pushback comes from students, most of them who don't stutter, thinking it's an ableist assignment to go out and pretend that you stutter. And I think you have to think about what the point of the assignment is. So, and the point is not to, at least in my eyes, the point isn't to totally understand how it feels to to stutter, because obviously doing it once or twice isn't what the lived experience of stuttering is like.
Right. But, yeah.
But I think a lot of speech therapy will have these goals or challenges they give to clients, including going and making phone calls to people, or going up and maybe like asking an employee a question, or maybe doing these things. And to a lot of people who stutter, that can be a high stress situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting if an SLP or an SLP student is willing to suggest a client do that and possibly experience shame that they feel, possibly experience a negative response from the person that they're talking to, and yet they don't feel comfortable enough to go out and do that same thing. So I don't think we should be asking clients to go out and do something that we as clinicians wouldn't feel comfortable to do.
That's a very fair point.
I think if I suggested to a client that they go and like go up to the cashier at Starbucks and say what they want instead of getting it on the mobile app, if I suggest that they do that, except if I'm not comfortable to go up and stutter in front of the barista, like I don't really know how much credibility that I have, because it's something that I'm not willing to do.
Yeah.
As well as I think it is valuable to see what some of the responses can be, because sometimes you might get very negative responses. You might get maybe a funny look from the cashier. You might get comments from the cashier. They might ask, oh, haha, did you forget your own name? If you stutter telling them what your name is.
Oh my gosh, have you gotten that question?
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's so, like, what? I can't even imagine.
Yeah. So I personally think the pseudo stuttering assignment isn't offensive because it's being done to understand on a very small level what some of the reactions might be if a client stutters in some of these situations. As well as, I think it's important that if the student clinician who is doing the assignment, if they feel uncomfortable doing some fake stuttering, that they can control how much stuttering they do. They can control how long they stutter for. They can pretty easily pick and choose if they have any secondary behaviors.
Yeah.
If they feel very uncomfortable doing that, imagine how it would feel to somebody who does stutter, who doesn't feel, who doesn't have control over how much they stutter, as well as who has a whole, as well as if they potentially have a whole lifetime of shame built up.
Yeah.
So I think it's an assignment that I don't find offensive. I think it can be valuable if it's done just to see what some of the responses might be, and to understand what we ask our clients to do.
Yeah. No. Thank you. That's an incredibly detailed and helpful answer, because I honestly, like, reading about that assignment and reading the different opinions, I was like, I have no idea like what I'm supposed to be taking away from this, because I could kind of see both sides of the argument. But as someone who doesn't stutter myself, I was like, I can't make this ableist claim that I see a lot of people making, because like, I feel like that's also, you can't make that claim unless a lot of those students were not people who stuttered who had the problem with the assignment. So I was like, yeah. Huh, that seems to be, but like you said, it kind of misses the point. I mean, I understand where people are coming from. It's either the ableist argument or it's the, you know, well, what's the point? You're not going to be able to simulate a lifetime of experience or a lived experience of someone who stutters. But like you said, that's not really the point of it. It's to imagine, it's to be able to put yourself in those situations that you are, as a clinician, probably going to be asking your clients to do. I mean, Matt, do you get the sense that this type of assignment is falling out of favor, or do you think it's been pretty consistent?
At least in the people I know, it seems like it is somewhat consistent in being assigned.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I know in me and Matt's experience being grad students, it's definitely something that we've been assigned and had to do before.
Yeah. And what was your experience doing that for both of you?
I felt a little bit uncomfortable. Like you said, it's kind of like hard to know what to do in that situation. But I think obviously my view is skewed because I have Matt as a peer. I can kind of ask his opinion and get his answer, which is exactly what he said to me when you asked him just now. So I think it made me feel, I understood the assignment a little bit more after talking to him, but I could totally see like someone who's in a program who's never even met someone who stutters being right. Like, is this right? Am I doing something wrong by doing this? I can totally understand where they're coming from with that.
We've talked about stuttering. We've talked about this idea of fluency versus disfluency. We've discussed difference versus disorder and all of these other, like, almost, I mean, it's almost silly to call them, I've heard it phrased as like secondary symptoms, I guess, of stuttering. But the more we talk, it seems like those, Matt, you're arguing that they're kind of the primary symptoms is the avoidance behaviors. It's the social stuff. So that is absolutely something that I think I would like to see. I think we'd all like to see kind of change in the way that that our field kind of discusses these things.
So I think there's a lot of like good stuff happening right now in the field, and that there is kind of a shift to focusing on like what is actually valuable to people who stutter. So I know that there's like a lot of that is being done. There's also a good number of like of professors who stutter and who also like do some of this research as well. I know that Dr. Naomi Rogers out of Iowa, she's somebody who stutters, and she's focusing more on like on sort of like how do people who stutter make positive change. And that's just kind of like things like that that are becoming the focus, and I think that that's pretty good. Right now at UConn, I'm doing my master's thesis with Dr. Tammy Spaulding about what people who stutter like value in speech therapy, things they find helpful, things they don't find helpful. So I think that there's a lot of that type of research that is coming out.
Not to put you on the spot, but are you going to publish your thesis?
That is what the goal is.
Ooh, that's exciting. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Definitely. When we have like a more solid timeline for that, we'll have to shout it out, because I'm sure anybody listening is going to want to
see what you're talking about
in more detail.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so much for helping us unpack our listener submitted question, our linkery of the day. But also, of course, for just sharing your such amazing in-depth experiences as an individual, as a student clinician, as a researcher, as a scientist, as an individual who stutters, as all of these like shades and colors that you are. It's really interesting to hear a perspective, and I think crucial at this. It sounds like we are kind of reaching almost an inflection point about fluency and stuttering within the field. So I'm really excited to see where this goes in the next like decade.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Thank you for having me on.
Of course, Matt. And I'm sure we'll be reaching out again, because something tells me you're going to have other great perspectives as we kind of make this podcast together and explore questions like this. So, all right.
Hey,
thank you again, Matt.
Yeah, thank you so much.